Let me begin this evening by asking you guys a question. And just kind of let your mind wander as it rings through your ears. What's the definition of greatness? According to dictionary.com, greatness is the quality of being great. I didn't think you were supposed to use the same word to describe another word, but that's what it says. The quality of greatness is the quality of being great, distinguished, or eminent. And as I even ask that question, chances are your mind goes directly to somebody that you probably perceive as great, or maybe it's something that you perceive as great, or some sort of example of greatness. For some, it may have been an athlete, or others, it may have been a musician, or an intellectual individual, or even a powerful, influential person, a businessman, a wealthy person, whatever it might be. There might be, when you say greatness, I want to achieve greatness. That's a new hashtag, I guess, hashtag greatness, and achieve greatness, and it's out there. But what does it really mean? What are we really striving for? What does it really look like? What are we really trying to achieve? What makes these people that would be examples to us of greatness, what makes them great? Typically, we define greatness by some sort of perceived success. We can look at someone and think, well, they've achieved greatness in their little area of life. And maybe even when it comes to our own greatness, most of us establish in our mind what we think greatness is. This is what we think it means to be great. And then we go out and try to achieve that and try to pursue that. But is that really greatness? Is that really the pinnacle of greatness? Or is that just something in our own mind that we've set up as greatness? You know, typically when we set it up, what happens when you get there, you realize, well, it's not that great at all. It's not that good. Truth be told, I don't know that we'd even recognize greatness among us. Unless it occurred within our little realm of reality. Have you ever noticed that within our culture, there's lots of little subcultures who all have little things that are important to them, but unless you're part of that subculture, you have no idea what they're talking about. They have their own language, their own terminology, their own measure of greatness, perhaps their own successes. But unless you're actually part of that realm, you just don't get it. Let me ask you another question. Would you recognize the best violin player in the world if you heard him play? If you heard him play, if he was up here playing and he played the best in the world, would you know the difference? Unless you come from that world, unless you listen to that music, unless you specialize in that, you would have no idea. On January 12, 2007, a man stopped in a D.C. metro station. He pulled out a violin and he began to play six pieces from Bach. And during that time, since it was rush hour, it was calculated that thousands of people walked through the station. Most of them were on their way to work. He played for 45 minutes. Only six people stopped and stayed for just a little while. The one who paid him the most attention was a three-year-old little boy, before mom hurried him off to wherever they had to go. Only 20 people stopped to throw a little bit of money into a hat that was laying on the ground, and then they hurried on. At the end, he'd collected $32. When he finished playing and silence took over, no one noticed it. No one applauded, nor was there any recognition. The violinist, his name was Joshua Bell. He's one of the best musicians in the world. He played one of the most intricate pieces ever written with a violin that was worth $3.5 million. Thousands of people walked by, didn't even recognize him. 2 days before playing in this subway, Joshua Bell sold out a theater in Boston, and the seats, on average, $100 a piece. Yet thousands walked by him every day, right there in the subway, didn't know what it was. How many of us would have recognized him? We would have been in a hurry like everyone else. Unless it's your type of music, unless it's your interest, probably none of us would have. What's your point, Rob? You see, the world defines greatness as in material possessions. It does it in cars, houses, net worth, and accomplishments, athletics, maybe achievements, awards, the power obtained. But is that really the right definition of greatness? I believe in the passage before us tonight, you will see there's a very big difference to how the world defines greatness and how the Lord defines greatness. I think you're going to see a huge difference. Jesus will use two of his apostles as an example to teach all 12 about spiritual greatness. You see, there's not a one of us that doesn't want to be great, but are we on the right path? Are we even headed in the right direction? The question you'll face is, which definition will you seek? Which definition will you attempt to achieve? Or better yet, who will be the one you're seeking to impress? Will it be yourself? Will it be others? Or will it be the Lord? Let's pick up in Matthew chapter 20, verse 17. Follow along as I read down to verse 28. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left, in your kingdom." But Jesus answered and said, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said to him, "We are able." So he said to them, "You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left, it's not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father." And when the ten heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself, and he said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Remember, at this place in our text, Jesus is on his way up to Jerusalem. He's going up to celebrate the Passover with his disciples. In fact, he had just told them, "Hey guys, we're going up to Jerusalem, and he refers to himself as the Son of Man. He says, when we get there, I will be betrayed to the chief priests and the scribes. I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to be turned over. They're going to condemn me to death. They're going to deliver me to the Gentiles who will mock me, who will scourge me, and who will crucify me. But on the third day, I will rise from the dead." That's what he told them just before what we read. And they're worried about becoming great. They're worried about what's going to happen. Because their expectation was so focused on Jesus's establishing an immediate political kingdom, they had the plan in their head. It's going to go this way. These words were so contrary that he spoke to their anticipation. In other words, they thought one thing. It was so contrary to what Jesus said, they didn't even register with their minds. They couldn't even grasp it. They didn't even get it. Now notice in the story who comes before Jesus. We read the mother of Zebedee, the mother of Zebedee's sons. That's Zebedee's wife. That's James and John and their mother. They come before Jesus. It appears she was a regular part of their group. She'll be mentioned again later in Matthew chapter 27. And you certainly can't blame a mom for wanting what's best for her sons. But is this the right way to get greatness? To go ask for it? Lord, beg for it? Sneak around? I want you to notice how they come to Jesus. It says they are kneeling down and they're asking something from him. They're kneeling down. Maybe your translation says they're worshiping. The King James says they're worshiping. Literally, those words for kneeling down means to prostrate oneself as a sign of worship. They are face down before Jesus. Sometimes it translates as bow down before or fall down before. And some scholars have contested this meaning, and they say it simply means to kneel down out of a respect or an honor. But I believe that mom and her sons are there before Jesus. They're flat on their faces in an act of worship. They're worshiping. Why? Because they want something. And if you want something, what do? Whatever it takes to get it. So it would make sense to me that they're worshiping. They're laying something out. They're on their faces. Notice what Jesus says as they're prostrate before him. And they're in verse 21. What's he say? He said to her, "What do you wish?" In other words, what do you want? Here they are. I just imagine this is some act of worship, some act of reverence. They're trying to impress him. What do you wish? What do you want? When you come before the Lord in worship, are you doing it because there's something you want? Are you doing it out of reverence for him? Are you only worshiping because you're getting ready to ask for something? In other words, "Lord, I'll worship you, but there's a question coming at the end. There's something I want. Lord, you're the great healer. Now heal me. Will you heal me? I gave you some worship. Lord, you're the great provider. Now I need you to provide for me financially. Lord, you're amazing. Now do something amazing for me." You see how their position of worship was solely so they could get what they were looking for. I think as Christians, we need to be careful that that's not our position of worship. We need to be careful that we're worshiping God for who he is and what he's done, not for what we can get out of him. Because then essentially what we do is we make him some sort of genie in a bottle that says, "I'll worship you, but it's contingent upon you doing what I want you to do. You see, that's what she's asking for. Don't try to butter the Lord up, which is what they were doing. Trying to look super spiritual, trying to look like they've got it all together. He knows your heart. He knows what they're about to ask for, some worldly physical thing. He knows what they're coming for. In other words, he even asked, what do you want? Why are you here? Come on, let's just cut to the chase. What do you want? Look, forget all the nonsense. Just tell me what you want. That's essentially what's happening here. And she says to him, there in verse 21, grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom. Now, when she asks about the right hand and the left, she's really saying, can they share your prestige and power? We know you're number one, but can they be two and three? Can they share that power and that prestige? Pick my kids over the other disciples. Pick them, Jesus. Give them a prominent position. Promise me now. Give it to me now. James and John, what are they doing there? They're seeking greatness. They want to be great in the kingdom. They want to be great next to Jesus. Not spiritual greatness. They're not seeking that. What are they seeking? Worldly greatness. What are they expecting? They're going to roll into Jerusalem. They're going to build the kingdom of Jerusalem. They're going to cast out the Romans. They're going to overthrow the Roman government. And Jesus is going to be king, and they're going to be great next to him. I'm going to be the number two guy. You'll be the number three guy. I wonder what kind of fight that caused between the brothers. Everybody that has more than one kid knows that they're always fighting over that kind of stuff, aren't they? I want to be number two. You be number three. And mom says, yeah, let's go ask him. Look how Jesus responds to them. He said, but Jesus answered and said in verse 22, you do not know what you ask. In other words, I just told you I was going to Jerusalem to die. I just told you that. And he says, are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and to be baptized with the baptism that I am about to be baptized with him? And they said to him, we're able. Sure, no problem. We got this. Notice Jesus seems to be looking at James and John. It's almost as if mom says, can they? And he looks at them and says, are you able to? I don't want to hear from mom about what you can do. I want to hear from you. Are you able to be baptized? Are you able to drink from the cup? Their answer seems to come pretty quickly. It seems to come without consideration, without counting the cost, without really knowing what they're getting. Yeah, we're able. Let's do it. We got this. We can do this, Lord. And I want you to notice the word baptized there. He's not talking about water baptism. There's nothing in the Bible speaks of many different baptisms, but we always think of baptism as water baptism. This has nothing to do with water baptism. The word for baptized, it means to immerse, to dip, or to be covered by. That's what the word physically means. Are you able to be covered by what I'm about to be covered by? Are you able to do that? Are you able to be covered by what I'm about to be covered by? Are you able to drink or to consume or endure what I am about to endure? Sure, no problem. That's their attitude. We got this. We can do this. Of course we can. Why? Because we got you with us. We just follow you around. Look how Jesus responds. And I believe his response here is with passion and with tenderness. I don't think he's being sarcastic. He understands their heart. He understands this. And he says, I'm going to teach them. I'm going to take this moment where they're seeking worldly greatness, and I'm going to teach them about what true greatness really is. I'm going to explain to them how to achieve spiritual greatness, how to achieve eternal greatness. Because if you've ever noticed, worldly greatness only lasts while you're the one on top. Mm-hmm. Ask any ex-athlete what happens after the younger guys come out and you get older. Mm-hmm. Ask anybody. You can't maintain that same level forever. We all get older, slower, fatter. We can't think as quick. It just happens. You can't continue at the same level that you did in your prime, whatever that might be. But Jesus says, I got a chance. They want greatness. I'm going to teach them about true greatness. I'm going to teach them about greatness that lasts forever. Verse 23, so he said to them, you will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left, it's not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father. He says, you will share in my baptism. You will drink from my cup. That's going to happen. And by the way, to drink from the cup meant to drink the full measure. It meant leaving nothing. It was a common expression that meant to stay with something to the end. You're going to finish it, to endure to the limits, whatever the cost. Can you do that? Yes, we can do that. And it's going to happen. But what must they be baptized in? What is it they must drink from the cup? Suffering. Suffering. You're going to have to be baptized in my suffering. You're going to be immersed in my suffering. You're going to have to consume all of my suffering. You're going to have to stay with it to the very end. Suffering. But their cups and their baptisms, they'd be different. They wouldn't look the same. James would go on to be the first martyr among the apostles. First one to be killed among the apostles. John would be the only apostle who doesn't die as a martyr, although it wouldn't be without trying. They tried to kill him a number of times. It's interesting, as this is going on, it's almost as if I can hear Jesus say, "Don't you realize? Don't you guys understand the way to eternal glory is not through worldly success and honor? It's not through the position you occupy, but it's through suffering. It's through suffering. You're going to have to be immersed in my suffering. You're going to have to drink from that cup. Haven't you heard what I've been teaching you about the persecuted being blessed? Haven't you understood about taking up your own crosses and following me? Haven't you got it yet?" You see, they hadn't got it yet. They hadn't understood it yet. They will get it when the Holy Spirit comes upon them. They're going to get the understanding that we have today sitting here. We get to look back at their life and go, "Look, you guys didn't get it yet." How many of us still don't get it yet? How many of us are still trying to achieve worldly greatness? And once you achieve it, you have to get onto something else because it doesn't last. I personally believe the ones who will have the greatest glory besides Christ in heaven will be the ones who faithfully endured the greatest sufferings for him on earth. And I mean that. Unfortunately, that won't be me, because I can honestly tell you, to this point in my life, I have not really suffered for the Lord. I have been nothing but blessed by the Lord. Sure, there's been difficulties, there's been some seasons, but I really haven't endured the kind of suffering that the apostles suffered, that Christians around the world are suffering. I just have not endured that. I haven't had that. I've never been put to that test. How many of you guys got a chance to take a look at Calvary Chapel Magazine this month? They're out there. There's a few left out there. Pick one up if you want. On the back is a little thing that tells the name of our church. You can drop it off at a doctor's office. Great place to leave them laying around about what's going on. But if you haven't got this, or if you don't, if we run out, you can grab one. You can go online and read it. I want to share something with you. Highlighted in Calvary Chapel Magazine this month is a ministry called Far Reaching Ministries. It's a man by the name of Wes Bentley. Started it down in the South Sudan. Wes has actually been to our church. He came here a few years back. And what Wes does, he trains chaplains in the South Sudanese army. There's a civil war going on down in the South Sudan. He trains these chaplains, but not only are they chaplains, they're soldiers. So they carry a Bible in one hand and a rifle in the other. And they go down, they protect these villages, they protect the women and children that are being invaded by the Muslims in the north coming down trying to take over their villages. And what Wes has done is he's trained them to be not only soldiers, but incredible pastors, and they take the gospel with them on the battlefield. And I want to share something with you. I found this incredibly moving. Every year he calls them all back to this base that they have down there in the South Sudan. And every year he addresses them to help them get refreshed. It's kind of like a conference for them. And then he gets them nourished, gets them strength, and gets them the medical treatment they need, and sends them back out onto the battlefield. And I want to share something with you. And I'm going to read to you from here. One night, Wes gravely addressed the men, and here's what he said. He said, "Many of us have fallen, and many more will." Okay? Just to give you an idea, here's a picture. I don't know if you can see that or not. Here's a picture of the men sitting in the church. It's a Calvary Chapel down there, sitting in there, hearing what they're teaching them. He says, "Many of us are falling and many more will." He said, "I've done the math. 1 in 8 of us is going to die for the gospel." Can you imagine looking around and going, 1 in 8 of us won't be here next year because we'll have given our life for the gospel of Jesus Christ. 1 in 8. 1 in 8 of us aren't going to make it back here next year. I want you to go home and tell your wives that you love them. I want you to pick up your children, tell them their daddy will always love them, and try to explain the calling of Christ on your lives. Go home, tell your family why you do what you do, why you're being a servant to the Lord, why you're protecting those that can't protect themselves. And it says he didn't expect their response. As he finished that sentence, they all stood up and they cheered. And it hit him that they considered dying for Christ the highest calling in this life. You'd think that when he said 1 in 8 aren't going to make it back, be like, "Oh, poor us." They didn't. They considered it the highest calling they could die for Christ in this life. I got to read one more story out of it. I wasn't planning on doing it, but it's incredible. if I can find it. This is one of the chaplains. His picture's right here in the magazine. Okay, Wes, I've met him. He's had lunch at our house. The ministry that's happening there is incredible. Chaplain Moses, a 15-year veteran, will be awarded the Knight's Cross, the Chaplain's Corps' highest award for bravery next year. It will be the first time this award has ever been given to a living chaplain. In 2013, his village was attacked by the rebel army while he was away serving. He's serving others and his family's getting attacked. Most of the women in the village were raped and killed. His pregnant wife and two children were taken away, and she was forced into sexual slavery for the next 3 years. 3 years. Yet Moses continued, almost broken, to serve soldiers and fight alongside of them. He realized that if his family was to be rescued, it would have to be the Lord making a way for him to do it. What Chaplain Moses did was put his trust in the Lord, and it was a powerful testimony to the men whose wives had not survived the same type of capture. When Moses learned where his wife was held, deep behind enemy lines, he asked to be taken there. And he watched for 14 grueling days until the opportunity came to rescue her. He knew, Wes stated, that if he didn't wait until he learned the horrific routine she endured daily, that he would die trying to save her, and her torment would continue. Once inside her tent, he gently put his hand over her mouth, and he told her, "Be quiet, my love. I have come for you." Seeing him, she was in shock because her captors had told her Moses was dead. They had to move quickly. Once it was discovered they had escaped, strong young men who excelled in tracking would chase and likely overrun them. Ultimately, after 4 days of 20-hour hikes with their three children, ages 3, 6, and 8, 20 miles a day for 4 days with three children, ages 3, 6, and 8, they arrived in safe territory. Although they're still very traumatized, she is now receiving good medical care, including treatment for deafness caused by repeated beatings to her head. Far-reaching Ministries is providing a home for her near their base. And Wes said, "I've seen many who have gone through similar circumstances. As we watch them in God's word, in time, they do heal." Greatness. Men giving their life for the gospel. Greatness. Too often in our society, we've attached greatness to an actor or an actress or to an athlete or to somebody who impresses us with worldly greatness or to a businessman who makes money because they're wealthy, because they have all the stuff and all the toys. Is that really what true greatness looks like? Is that really where we find value? Our society would say yes. The Christian should say no, not at all. All right, back to James and John. Jesus had told them, yes, it's going to happen just like you asked. Yep, it's going to happen. You're going to drink of my cup. You're going to be baptized with my baptism. It's going to happen. But where you sit, on my right hand or on my left, what did Jesus say? It's not mine to give. It's not mine to give. Jesus is in total submission to the Father. He's in total submission to the Father. He would not even claim the right to choose how his servants are rewarded. He said, that's not mine. That's up to you to do that. He yielded that to his Father. Aren't you glad he didn't say, yeah, I kind of always liked you guys the best. Yeah, you two are always my favorite. Sons of Thunder, all right, I like it. You guys, all right, you can have the right and the left. No, there's no favoritism with the Lord. The decision is not based on who he likes better, but on the Father's choice. Now, how do you think the other apostles are going to respond when they hear this? What do you mean you went and asked for position number 2 and 3? That's not right. Look at verse 24. And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. Why were they greatly displeased? Because they were envious. They were jealous. They probably thought that he said, okay, you can have it. They resented them for asking. But it wasn't like they hadn't thought about it. It wasn't like they didn't want the same positions. It wasn't like they were super spiritual. They had already had an argument about who would be the greatest on the road to Capernaum. They already told them about that. James and John, they were just trying to get a jump on good seats in the kingdom. How can we get there first? We want those most prominent positions. But here's what I want you to see. Notice how Jesus takes the request of a mom and two men who are seeking worldly greatness, and he tells them how to achieve spiritual greatness. There is no lasting worldly greatness. You can't tell me who was the greatest, whatever. You picked the thing 50 years ago, 10 years ago, Who won the Super Bowl 12 years ago? Who won the Super Bowl 3 years ago? What if that's your thing? Whatever it is. Who was the greatest violin player in 1900? Whatever it is, whatever your thing that you look to greatness, how far back can you really go? Look what he says in verse 25. I love this. He called them to himself. They're bickering. They're fighting. Why did you guys go ask? That's not your position to ask. We should be second and three. They're back and forth. Guys, come on over here, he says. He calls them to himself and he says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. In other words, this is the way the world does it, but it's not going to be that way among you. Whoever desires to become great among you, in other words, guys, you want to be great? I'm going to tell you how to be great. Let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. There they are, all gathered together. Jesus reminds them of how the rulers of the world rule. They lord it over them. The greatest ones exercise authority over those who are not so great. The more power you had, the more authority you had. The phrase lord it over, it means this. It means to dominate completely. Dominate. How many times do we hear that describe an athlete? He dominates on the basketball court. He dominates on this. He dominates on that. She does this. The rulers of this world dominate everyone they can. And somehow they're ascribed greatness from the world. But Jesus said, it's not going to be that way among you guys. Christians, disciples, it's not going to be that way. You're not going to go out and try to dominate someone. What are you going to do? You're not going to operate like the world operates. You will not achieve greatness like the world achieves greatness. So often we define greatness by domination. That's an adjective that we will define someone who's great. We'll describe them that way. One person dominates all others in their little world, they get the title of being great. And if you really think you're the best over not only your time period, they'll call you the GOAT, the greatest of all time. That's the football world going around right now. If you're not familiar with it, he's the GOAT, the greatest of all time. Domination, who's going to remember him in 100 years? Nobody. What's it going to get him in the kingdom? Nothing if he's not doing it for the glory of God. Nothing. Being the greatest violin player on this earth will get you nothing in God's kingdom unless you're doing it for the glory of God. Unless he's the one getting the glory. Being the greatest athlete in your sport, getting the highest honors, receiving the greatest award will get you nothing in God's kingdom unless you're doing it for his glory. Being the richest, most successful businessman means nothing in eternity unless you're doing it for the Lord. So how do we achieve greatness in God's economy in eternity? He told you right there. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. Servant. If you want to be great, don't seek prominence. Seek service. Don't say, who's praying for me? Who cares about me? Instead, ask, how can I serve you? How can I serve you? Who can I serve? Come to the place where it's not about you. It's not about you. But I don't like that. No one will know who I am. I won't get any awards. I won't get any recognition. I won't get my name in the paper. No one will put me on Facebook. Oh, you'll get awards. You'll get recognition. Just maybe not on this earth. They'll come in eternity. The word for servant there, the Greek word is diakonos. It's a person who renders service. A servant. It's a servant. It's where the term deacon comes from. Maybe you've heard of a deacon in a church. It means a servant. Someone who does menial labor and just simple everyday tasks for the people. That's what it means. It's the lowest level of hired help who needed little training or skill. They just served. They just did whatever they were told. They did whatever they needed to do. It's just, what can I do today? Set up chairs, take down chairs, clean bathrooms. You don't need special training to do that kind of stuff. Servants, be a servant. Jesus chose this word to characterize obedient discipleship because it best reflects the selfless and humble life that he honors. So often we want to be somebody, and he says, be nobody. Serve somebody. You don't need to be somebody. You need to serve somebody. You will be somebody in eternity by serving others. Pastor, servant. I think it should say that way. I think that's the best title, servant. It would help a lot of pastors, including myself, remind me what our job description really is. Servant. Serve the people. Minister to the people. Anyhow, every way that you can. Whatever the Lord has called you to. Real ministry is done for the benefit of those ministered to, not for the benefit of the minister. Not for the benefit of the pastor. Many people are in the ministry for what they can receive, either materially or emotionally. They want to be recognized from the people they're serving instead of what they can give. If you have a desire to be in ministry, if you oversee a ministry, if you're, we all have a ministry, you have to serve. What can we give out? What can I give out? Not what can I take, what can I receive? I would encourage people that come to church. How can I help the church? Many times people come to church with the idea, I want, give me, give me, give me, give me. How can you help? How can you serve? Where can you fit in? What is the Lord calling you to do? How can you give back? Jesus, he didn't receive anything from anybody. He served. His life was a life of giving. He gave all the way up to the cross. Who was he thinking about? You and me, us. It wasn't for him. He didn't do it for him. There was no selfish way of enduring that suffering. It wasn't like he was getting some kind of weird, twisted, you know, prideful thing because he was suffering. He gave it. He did it for us. What did he say in the Garden of Gethsemane? Father, if there be any other way, let this cup, let this ending pass me by. Nevertheless, not my will be done, but yours. What an example. You want an example of greatness in your life? It's Jesus Christ. Stepped out of heaven, humbled himself, came to earth as a man, relied on the Holy Spirit all the way to the cross so that you could be forgiven of your sins. Talk about serving others. Unbelievable. He gave his life as a ransom for many, for all those who would believe on him. The word for ransom, it's a term commonly used for the redemption price of a slave, the amount required to buy their freedom. A slave could be purchased for a ransom price. If you paid that price, you could set them free. He gave a ransom for many. The unbeliever, if you're an unbeliever tonight, or if the unbeliever, you are a slave to sin, to the flesh, to Satan, and ultimately to death. You're a slave. And he wanted to redeem men from those slaveries. He paid the ransom. He gave his life in exchange for sinners. Unbelievable. I can't believe it. I want you to notice, Jesus also said, whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Now, if you were here on Sunday, that word for slave right there, it's doulos. The same word that we saw for bond servants that Peter used in the beginning of 2 Peter. Now, if you missed the study on what a doulos is, you'll have to go back and listen to it because I don't have time to cover it tonight. But that's what he's saying there. Now, let's look at the next section there and finish up the chapter this evening. There in verse 29. Now, as he went out of Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And behold, two blind men sitting by the road, when they heard that Jesus was passing by, cried out, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. And the multitude warned them that they should be quiet. But they cried out all the more, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. So Jesus stood still, and he called them. And he said, what do you want me to do for you? They said to him, Lord, that our eyes may be opened. So Jesus had compassion, and he touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight, and they followed him. Jericho is a bit of a desert oasis in the wilderness that surrounds the Dead Sea. Even today, there is a huge freshwater spring that flows out of Jericho. We were there in last spring when we stopped. We went to Jericho. We saw the spring. We saw the area. We visited Jericho. It's the area right above as you come out of the Jordan Valley going up towards Jerusalem. It's right about that area. It's about 800 feet below sea level. Jesus is starting his ascent up to Jerusalem there. He's going to go all the way to about 2,500 feet above sea level. So we have roughly 3,000 feet of elevation he's going to change. From Jericho to Jerusalem, it's about a 9-hour walk. You could walk it in about 9 hours, so it's a relatively not too long, but it's not real close either. So it's they're on their way up. There's these two blind men. They're desperate. In that day, most blind people were beggars. They didn't have anybody to take care of them. They're likely sitting around the city gate of Jericho, and they probably heard the commotion. What's going on? Who are all the people following him? What's happening? They likely had heard the stories of other people being healed by Jesus, and so they cried out. What do they have to lose? They're already blind. They're probably already destitute. They cry out, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." And when it says they cried out, it means they yelled loudly, and the word literally means as a woman does during childbirth. That's the type of crying out that they're doing. This is not someone speaking in a nice, pleasant, loud voice. This is someone crying out so the whole crowd can hear. Everybody over top can hear them. They're crying out. The crowd, what do they do? Shh, stop it, you're annoying us. Go away. Be quiet. They tried to quiet them down. But these guys were persistent. It says they cried out all the more. This was their only hope of being healed. They'd heard the stories. They cried out in faith. Cried out to him. When a person steps out to God on all the faith they have, that's what they're doing. Even if it's incomplete and weak, the Lord's going to meet them right where they're at. They're crying out twice, even amongst the people couldn't silence them. They're going to keep crying out. But notice their words. Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. By calling Jesus a Son of David, they were glorifying him. They were declaring him as the Messiah. One commentator said they gave him full honor with this title. By calling him the Son of David, they're saying, we recognize you're the Messiah. Have mercy on us. They didn't even ask for healing, did they? Now they are in a way, they're going to in a minute, but have mercy on us. We know who you are. We know who we are. Show us mercy, Lord. Oftentimes we don't know who we are. Sometimes we know who he is, but we don't really realize who we are. We don't realize that we can be blind by sin. We can be destitute because of sin, and we need to cry out to him. They cried out. The first time the crowd said, shh, be quiet, but they continued. By calling out, they're glorifying him. And notice Jesus' response. There in verse 32, it said, so Jesus stood still and he called them. And he said, what do you want me to do for you? I can't help but wonder, why didn't Jesus answer the first time? Why didn't he stand still the first time? Maybe he was waiting for direction from the Father. Maybe he wanted to see if they would be persistent. The truth is, we don't know why he didn't answer the first time, but we know they continued to cry, and he stood still, and then he asked them a question. He said, what do you want me to do for you? You got my attention. I stopped. What do you want me to do for you? I wonder how many times we've cried out to the Lord, and he said the same thing. What do you want me to do for you? And we don't answer. We don't hear. Maybe we only ask once. James told us we have not because we ask not. What do you want me to do for you? What if they'd have looked and just gone, oh, well, I don't know. I just want to see if you listen. Maybe he would have kept walking. But you know what? These men knew exactly what they wanted the Lord to do for them. What did they say? We want you to restore our sight. We want you to heal us. We want you to give us our eyesight back. Lord, open our eyes, heal our eyes. And what does he do? He had compassion on them. I love the Lord's heart. As powerful, as strong, as mighty of a man he was a compassionate man. Compassionate. He looked at their circumstance and said, oh, I have compassion on them. And then he touched their eyes and he restored their sight. Immediately they received their sight. And what did they do? They followed him. Don't forget that last part. They followed him. They followed him. The Bible tells of other people who were healed and didn't follow him, but they recognized the source of their healing and they followed him. Their blindness, their eyesight had been restored. Their blindness was taken away, and they were going to worship and follow the one who had taken it away. If the world describes greatness as domination, please understand the difference. The Bible describes greatness as service to others. Service to others. It doesn't mean that you have to walk around on this life letting everybody tell you exactly what to do. Nobody told Jesus what to do except the Father. But yet he found a way to serve all those the Father wanted him to serve. See, there will be some people that hear this message and go, well, I've got to serve other people. And they will pile all this stuff on them that they think they have to do to fulfill this service to others. That's not what he's asking you. What he's asking you is develop a relationship with me. Let me lead you in service to others. Put yourself aside and put others first. Whether that be your husband, or your wife, or your children, or your neighbors, or your boss, or your employees, or your coworkers, whoever that might be in your life, how can I serve them? Ask yourself that question tomorrow. How can I serve my kids? How can I serve my wife? How can I serve my boss? How can I serve them? Rob, I don't want that kind of greatness. I want the greatness that's going to get me some recognition. Then just understand you're seeking after worldly greatness. And when you get it, it's not going to be all that you think it is. It's really not going to satisfy you. There'll be an emptiness that's still there. But when you serve others, and please understand, it's not easy to serve someone else. Because you know what happens when you serve others? People treat you like a servant. And we don't like that. If the world describes greatness as domination, the Bible describes greatness as service to others, which one will you pursue? What are you going to pursue? Tomorrow, when you go to work, what are you chasing after? Doesn't mean you can't be good at what you do. It just means you have to examine your heart in doing it. Why am I doing it? Am I doing it for the Lord? Am I doing what I'm doing for the glory of God? It doesn't mean that the best violinist player in the world can't achieve greatness because he or she's doing it for the glory of God. Absolutely. They're going to be rewarded in the kingdom for using the gifts and talents that God gave them. But am I doing it for the glory of God, or am I doing it for my own glory? And here's how you can tell who's on display. Who's getting the recognition? Is it you, or is it the Lord? Are we able to say, no, don't recognize me. Don't recognize me. I can assure you that what God has done through our church to this point and what he continues to do is a result of his work, not mine. He could take anybody and do what I've done, and it's not a big deal. I'm just a person that said, all right, Lord, I'll go. I'll do what you ask me to do. Anybody, any one of you could go do exactly what I've done. If he calls you to do it, he'll empower you to do it. He'll equip you to do it. It's just the way that he works. What has he called you to do? And will you serve him, and in doing so, serve others? I challenge you tonight, your definition of greatness. You say, well, I don't even want to be great. I don't want to be anything. I just want to go about my life. I don't think that's the right attitude. I think that we have to have a desire to be great. We all have a desire to be great. You might not even admit it, but you still have a desire to be good at what you do. Listen to the way you talk about yourself. Everybody paints themselves in the best light, don't we? In our own little world, in our own little kingdom, this is why I'm so good at what I do. Why? Because we want to be good. We want to be better than someone else. That's just a natural thing. And I just want you to realize that there's greatness. You can chase greatness on the earth, and it's never going to fulfill. But if you'll chase greatness with Christ, if you'll give your life to serving the gospel, and not all of us are going to be called to go on a battlefield with a rifle to defend a village. That's not it. Many of us are going to be called to go to work tomorrow and serve with the gospel of Jesus Christ in our hearts. Many of us aren't going to suffer the way that the stories that we read here. We're not going to have a chance to suffer for that cry. But if you had to, would you be willing? Knowing the Lord would strengthen you and provide all the faith that you need to do that. You see, many of us aren't even willing to do it at work tomorrow or next week. You see, I know, I've come to learn that greatness in eternity is far better than greatness on this earth. But yet I also know there's still a flesh that says, I want people to recognize me. And I recognize it's a battle, and it will always be a battle in all of our lives until the day that we meet him face to face. But it doesn't mean that we quit fighting. It doesn't mean that we quit serving. It doesn't mean that when someone doesn't treat us right, we get frustrated. You're going to get frustrated. You're going to have difficulty, but you have to keep going. What did Paul say? Finish the race. There's a start and a finish to every race, and your life is a race. There's a start and a finish. I heard Wes Bentley say, not everyone's made to be 70 years old to his soldiers. Not everyone's going to live to be 70. Some of you guys are going to die young. But when you do it serving the Lord. Wow. We have a blessing to serve the Lord here where we're at. Maybe it's a curse, I don't know. But we have a chance to serve him. Will you take the gospel with you tomorrow? And will you find others to serve? Let's pray. Father, as we hear about greatness, we're naturally influenced by our environment. Perhaps it's the figures that we see on TV, perhaps it's the events that we watch for entertainment, whatever it might be. But Lord, I just ask tonight that you would refocus us. One thing the early church had was an eternal perspective. That's what helped them endure the difficulties, the suffering. James and John. James would be killed first, martyred. John would go on for the rest of his life, some would suggest into his 90s, serving you, Lord, suffering for you, boiled in hot oil, cast off to the island of Patmos, yet writing and teaching on love. Lord, I just pray that somehow you would help us see a little more clearly what our calling is, perhaps on the short term. And help us to have this heart that says we want to serve others more than we want to serve ourselves. It doesn't come naturally. It's a decision that we have to make. And Lord, we'll fall short. And we know that we have your grace and your mercy for it. We need that. But you've given us the perfect example in Jesus Christ. And that we serve others. In Jesus' name, amen.